Welcome to Pomegranate Health. I'm Mick Cavazzini. This is the first of two episodes on acute coronary syndrome. In mid-May, we'll talk about secondary prevention therapy and some new findings about predictors of adherence. But today we're going to discuss diagnosis of patients presenting with possible ACS. Before getting into the show, I want to highlight another great resource for members of the RACP. The College Learning Series is a catalogue of video lectures on every topic relating to the basic training curriculum, with new lectures added every week. Once you're done listening here, you can check out talks on the management of ACS and on coronary intervention at elearning.racp.edu.au. The incidence of all acute coronary events in 2015 was around 406 per 100,000 Australians over the age of 25, according to estimates from the AIHW. In New Zealand, this would scale to over 610 people per 100,000, where the mortality due to ischemic heart disease is worse than the average for OECD member countries. Calculating mortality rate associated with ACSS is complicated, but somewhere between 10 and 25% of acute coronary events are fatal. These aren't just STEMI heart attacks, but also non-STEMIs and cases of unstable angina pectoris. Distinguishing these and other differential diagnoses sometimes requires a range of investigations and the expertise of an emergency physician. But there will be generalists listening who make these workups while manning the fort in an understaffed or rural ED. The 2016 guidelines of the Cardiac Society of Australia and New Zealand were developed to assist in the evaluation of patients presenting with symptoms suggestive of acute coronary syndrome. One of the main authors was Associate Professor Louise Cullen.
My name's Louise Cullen. I'm an emergency physician at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital here in Queensland. I've been interested for a number of years in troponin and testing of patients who've got symptoms that may be an acute coronary syndrome. I've done over 10 years worth of research in this area and have been very fortunate to be involved with the Heart Foundation and the Cardiac Society of Australia and New Zealand guidelines.
And that's why we've got you here, to sort of walk us through those guidelines for those that haven't read the full 60 pages.
There's a longer version.
It took me a couple of days, but I managed to get it down to three, so we'll see.
Yeah, it took me a couple of years to write my section. Like, seriously, it was a two-year process writing my section alone.
So, of course, the key symptom that raises concern for an acute ischemic event is of course, chest pain. And importantly, you say in the guidelines it must have lasted for 20 minutes or more, but may have resolved by the time that the patient gets to hospital. Can you elaborate a bit more about how else the pain or the symptoms might be described by a patient? Are there less obvious symptoms?
One of the most challenging things about patients with acute coronary syndromes is the way that they present. It's very easy with the typical symptoms, the chest pain that you talk about, but we know that up to half people that do have ACS don't actually have those symptoms. They present things like shoulder pain, jaw pain, sometimes it's upper abdominal pain, but it may not be pain at all or discomfort at all. It might be things like shortness of breath or nausea or vomiting. Fatigue is something that we see, particularly in our older female population, but they might also present with sweating or palpitations as well. So it can be quite varied, which is why it's not an easy diagnosis to make, particularly not on history alone.
The guidelines tell you to keep an eye out for patient cohorts in whom atypical presentations are more frequently encountered. For example, people with diabetes, women, older patients, those with mental illness. And it's also mentioned that no historical features can rule out acute coronary syndrome in someone with chest pain, and that referral to ED should not depend on troponin results. As you're getting the ECG on them, starting the workup, would you administer any anticoagulants or antiplatelet therapy as a precaution right away?
So in patients that we believe have got possible acute coronary syndrome, aspirin should be given unless there's any contraindications, and we should give that as soon as possible for its antiplatelet properties. But other therapies that are talked about in the actual management of patients who have a proven ACS, things like beta blockers, we don't give unless there is confirmation of that diagnosis.
And what about any pain medication?
So there's a number of options available to us at the moment. You'd find that probably the first option is always GTN or nitroglyceride. Sublingual is usually what is the route of administration initially, and that can be by a tablet or a spray. But if after three doses there's no relief of pain, we need to look for other alternatives. And they include things like giving the GTN intravenously, but also giving IV narcotics. We tend to use fentanyl over morphine after some recent studies have shown that onset of action of ticagrelor can be slowed with morphine.
Right.
We also don't tend to give non-steroidal anti-inflammatories because they actually increase the risk of cardiac events in patients who have got an acute coronary syndrome.
Chest pain and other symptoms suggestive of acute coronary syndrome might make up a quarter of all hospital admissions. In a study at the Royal Brisbane Emergency Department led by Louise Cullen, 11% of suggestive presentations went on to have a diagnosis of ACS confirmed. A multi-centre US study put this figure at 17%. But follow-up studies of discharged patients show that up to 6% of diagnoses are missed, and these patients have a twofold higher mortality rate than those who are admitted. A 2000 paper in the New England Journal of Medicine reports that missed diagnoses were more likely in women under 55 years of age, patients who reported shortness of breath as their chief symptom, in those without an aberrant ECG, and in non-white patients. The Cardiac Society guidelines present a systematic way of differentiating ACS from other forms of chest pain in order of clinical urgency. First, you want to identify the occurrence of a myocardial infarction with ST segment elevation on electrocardiogram recordings. If STEMI is discounted, the next most important step is to rule out other life-threatening causes of chest pain. Third in the diagnostic hierarchy is to establish whether there's been myocardial infarction without ST elevation or unstable angina. But we'll get to that a bit later. So starting with STEMI, the diagnosis of course requires a 12 electrode ECG, and the Cardiac Society guidelines recommend that these be read by an expert within 10 minutes of initial contact. How commonly does this happen?
So I think that it depends a little bit, of course, in your space and place that you're at. There wouldn't be a clinical shift where I wouldn't see 10 or 20 ECGs to interpret. Outside of metropolitan areas, you would find that there would be people that might be less familiar with the interpretation of these ECGs. A number of patients will be presenting to primary care, to general practice as well. There is, though, with most ECG machines that are available, some inbuilt interpretive functions as well. And they are often useful in the setting of your classic STEMI. The computer-assisted interpretation is actually not too bad. If it says it's an acute myocardial infarction, you really need to find a reason why it's not if you're going to go against it.
Okay.
The trouble with some of these interpretive functions is that they're not sophisticated enough to pick up some of the subtle changes or some of the what we call STEMI equivalents. And depending on whereabouts you live, there are also different strategies which support our primary care physicians in rural practices sending the pre-hospital ECGs through for interpretation. And even this day and age with iPhones and other things, taking a photo and sending it to your local cardiologist for support is hopefully readily available for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So we might just describe what this looks like for the physician that does end up reading these themselves. So the ST segment of the ECG is normally a small plateau representing a shift from depolarization to repolarization of the ventricles. How dramatic is the elevation in a STEMI?
It can be subtle, and believe it or not, there's actually gender differences as well, and age differences. So it's become more complex recently with some new guidelines that suggest that for men who are under 40, we're talking about more than 2.5 millimetres of ST segment elevation. For men that are over 40, it's 2 millimetres alone. In women, 1.5 millimetres. And in terms of left bundle branch block, for example, if there's a new development of left bundle branch block, it's more than 1 millimetre. And there's also subtle things. What we see early in STEMIs is really a ramping rather than a plateau. And this, although it doesn't meet the criteria for thrombolysis, it is a situation where you want to do repeated ECGs to look for changes. And anyone with ongoing chest pain, you want to continually repeat those ECGs to see if you then meet the criteria for intervention.
Mm. Let's just recap some of the nomenclature. Perhaps the ECG traces V1 to 6 correspond directly to voltage recorded at those chest electrodes, whereas the traces labelled in Roman numerals correspond to the subtractive difference or leads between two of the limb electrodes. Now, depending which of the ECG traces show an ST elevation, an expert can localise the infarct to a specific wall of the left ventricle. But the Cardiac Society guidelines, as a first point, say to focus on chest electrodes V2 and V3. What's the rationale for that recommendation?
The rationale is very much that an anterior myocardial infarction is the widow maker. Mm. So these anterior or septal leads, you know, V1 to 2 and then the anterior V3 to 4, have high mortality. So for that reason, we're wanting people not to miss those.
Right, so it's pointing to the most severe outcomes, not necessarily the majority of presentations.
That's right. When we talk about ST segment elevation, we're very much looking at particular leads. There are STEMI equivalents, for example, a posterior MI, where you won't have ST segment elevation at all. You'll actually have ST segment depression, and yet it's pathognomonic of a STEMI that needs acute treatment. So it's rather complex in its interpretation, unfortunately.
So ST elevation is a sensitive and specific marker of myocardial infarction. The guidelines say that this is enough on its own to require progression to immediate reperfusion of the patient. So how immediate typically? Do you have to take serial recordings before you're absolutely sure?
Generally not in the right clinical context. And any delays, you may be, for example, if you're in a region which does not have access to PCI, you may be beginning to organise your thrombolytic agent while you do a second ECG for sometimes backup and reassurance. If you believe you've got that STEMI, time is of the essence to ensure the best outcome for this patient. And this is where you get the classic, time is muscle.
You mentioned PCI. The guidelines say that percutaneous coronary intervention is preferred over fibrinolytic therapy as it saves 2 additional lives per 100. And that it may even be worth transferring patients from a non-PCI-capable centre. But that benefit of PCI is lost if there's a delay greater than 2 hours. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some caveats to that, though. And for many of our places in regional and non-metropolitan centres, and even in some metropolitan centres without access, ready access to the cardiac catheter lab, the only option is fibrinolytic therapy. We know, though, that if you have given fibrinolytics and that there is ongoing chest pain and discomfort, or there is less than 50% ST segment recovery at the 1 hour mark, we should then be thinking about access for rescue angioplasty for these patients. Mm-hmm. So there's a place for both of these, because even though this idea of transferring patients is a good one, you have to be able to ensure that the person's going to be able to get that blood vessel open within a short period of time, and just the sheer means of inter-hospital transfers often means that it's longer than 2 hours, so we've got to be very careful about what we advise. But there are some contraindications. There's patients who are at high risk of bleeding, for example, where fibrinolytic therapy is contraindicated.
And the guidelines also point to other conditions that may cause ST elevation on the ECG: pericarditis, Brugada syndrome, and Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which may require angiography for their differentiation. But if you haven't done this, would you still rather risk reperfusion of someone with that condition rather than not reperfusing someone who had suffered an acute MI?
So the key part here is really in the context of what's going on. The clinical picture with someone with pericarditis is very, very different. And the same also for Brugada. You often see those changes in someone that is pain-free without, suspicion of an ACS. And there are some additional, apart from the ST segment changes, there's other changes that you'll see in an ECG in someone with Brugada that will let you know that it's there.
Okay.
There are difficulties, of course, in some conditions, such as the Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy. But here we're at a harm versus benefit situation. So the harm that is done by not reperfusing someone with a STEMI is significant. The most common serious condition that we see with ST segment elevation is a STEMI, and not some of these other ones that are mimickers of it. And equally, I think when you put it in the right context, it's not as difficult as what it probably sounds if you just look at the ECG alone.
If there's no elevation of the ST segment in the ECG, the next most important step on the diagnostic checklist is to rule out other life-threatening conditions that could cause chest pain. These are pulmonary embolism, aortic dissection, and tension pneumothorax. In younger patients, myocarditis and pericarditis might also be considered, although they are quite rare. To detect tension pneumothorax, a chest X-ray is the way to go. But ruling out the other differential diagnoses requires a combination of tools and clinical assessment. A sensitive biomarker for myocardial necrosis is circulating troponin protein. In the context of acute chest pain with normal ECG, a positive cardiac troponin assay would suggest heart attack without ST elevation. But pulmonary embolism can also raise blood troponin. So as Louise Cullen explains, the profile and timing of signals is all important.
Yeah, look, it tells us that there is myocardial injury or myocardial necrosis, but doesn't tell us the cause of it. Unfortunately, troponin can be elevated in a pulmonary embolism as well. If we're going to think down that way, then we need to think about our other investigative modalities and equally about their levels of risk. So low-risk patients, we would use D-dimers, but intermediate and high-risk patients need either VQ scanning, so nuclear med scanning, or CT pulmonary angiography to rule out or identify pulmonary embolism. And as our troponin assays are getting more sensitive in terms of analytical sensitivity, we can detect troponin in a lot more conditions. So people who've got renal impairment, for example, subarachnoid hemorrhages, sepsis, burns. But you can also see it in people who are ultra-fit marathon runners.
So despite these other conditions that can elevate troponin, if you do see it continually increasing, that's a way to differentiate myocardial infarction from other causes.
Absolutely, because as you can imagine, if there's an acute infarction, you'd see an increase over a period of hours if it's acute.
Yeah.
There are occasions, though, where you see patients that are presented late and they have sometimes had chest pain 2 or 3 days before, but it hasn't gone away. And so you then might be at the tail end of their troponin release, and so you might be beginning to see a fall then. So a single value is not going to help us. You need to do serial tests to see if there is a change, because you need to see a rise or fall of troponin values.
Okay. Now, newer high-sensitivity troponin assays can detect concentrations of blood troponin 10 times lower than the previous ones and allow earlier detection of myocardial damage. How has this increased sensitivity and precision changed the dynamics of the diagnostic process?
So it's important to remember that when we talk about the increased sensitivity for the detection of troponin, it's not the same thing as sensitivity for myocardial infarction, because as you can see, we're actually now picking up a number of different conditions. So one of the benefits of the higher sensitivity troponin assays is that we can do serial testing over a shorter period of times.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't need additional tests. You know, gone are the days when we used to do a number of different biomarkers to try and identify if people had had a myocardial infarction. It also means there's been a little bit of a shifting around in terms of more patients are now diagnosed probably with non-STEMIs and fewer with unstable angina, which is your troponin negative state, because we have got this ability to detect accurately very small or very low elevations of troponin now with the high sense assays.
One caveat of troponin assays is that the time range over which the patient might show an elevation can vary quite a bit. Can you elaborate on this, whether it's the tests or just patient biological variability?
So in terms of the timing and how long do you need to do blood tests to ensure that someone has a heart attack or doesn't have a heart attack, it very much does depend firstly on the test that you're using and the analytical sensitivity of it. The second part, though, is the troponin getting into the circulation as well, the pathophysiology that's going on. Is there any circulation past that necrosed myocardium that actually then circulates that troponin back to allow us to detect it peripherally? It gets really complex in this area in the sense that all of these different assays by different manufacturers perform slightly differently. So, for example, our point-of-care troponins, you may actually need to extend testing out to 10 to 12 hours. But in our high-sensitivity troponins, most people you'll be able to detect that change within 3. And then the sensitive ones that are still commonly available, it might be of the order of 6 hours. When it is elevated, it can remain elevated for 2 weeks. So we are in a situation now where we're having to do research to ensure that we have got the right rules for the right assays. And what I mean by that is the right different numerical values that we should be applying. And that includes us being able to rule out people, but also identify people who have had myocardial infarction sooner as well. because there is such a difference in the way these tests perform, you need to know what your local assay is. You need to know what its cut points are and how it performs. And you need to use that really well. When you've got patients that are presenting that have had blood tests done across two different assays, you can't just change around, you know, decimal places, for example, or change the reference intervals and use those same values. You need to start again.
Now, in terms of managing non-ST elevation MI, the recommended management is angiography and revascularization by PCI, or in some cases, bypass surgery, except in the case of type 2 myocardial infarction, which makes up 14% of cases. So if we describe type 1 as your classic plaque rupture and thrombus, what causes the damage in type 2 myocardial infarction?
Type 2 MI is a term that is given where you have a supply-demand imbalance of oxygen that's caused by something other than coronary artery disease. So you can have something like coronary artery spasm, for example, or sepsis, for example, with like pneumonia, where patients have got increased demand but just may not be able to maintain the adequate coronary perfusion to therefore cause that myocardial necrosis. You can also have things like tachyarrhythmias that cause that same sort of condition. A lot of underlying seriously unwell people have got type 2 MIs if we looked for them all. The issue at the moment is that we don't have specific treatment targeted for the type 2 MI itself. The key thing that we need to focus on to optimise these patients' outcome is by treating the underlying condition well, identifying the sepsis, treating that, treating whatever's causing the tachyarrhythmia, for example, rather than having something that is specifically cardiologically directed at the myocardium themselves.
In patients with normal troponin and ECG, then myocardial infarction is ruled out. If the chest pain is brought on with less and less stress on each attempt at exertion, then a diagnosis of unstable angina should be suspected. Patients in the high-risk category can be investigated with coronary angiography to localise obstructed arteries, which may then lead to percutaneous coronary intervention or bypass surgery. Risk stratification is important for reducing unnecessary investigation and therapy. With conventional troponin assays, serial testing over several hours could lead to overnight stays for many patients, increasing the burden to them and to the healthcare system. High-sensitivity troponin assays have enabled accurate assessment to take place within 2 hours of presentation. Accelerated diagnostic protocols take this measure into account, along with scores for other risk factors such as family history, comorbid diabetes, and smoking. Louise Cullen explains other criteria which contribute to a high-risk stratification.
Probably the commonest thing that we see is people with ongoing symptoms of ischemia, so ongoing chest pain that is very difficult to manage. But there are other things such as hemodynamic compromise, for example, if they develop arrhythmias or acute heart failure. If they've got ECG changes that are recurrent in terms of, you know, they get better as you improve things, and as I said, they're symptomatically not improving, and so they get recurrent dynamic changes of their ST segments or also T-wave changes. They're the sorts of conditions that would put person into a high-risk category for UAP. Then there's a few criteria that we believe are a low-risk population now. You know, young people under the age of 40 just generally don't have acute coronary syndromes, but there's caveats to that. There are populations that aren't necessarily grouped in that same, you know, people, for example, like Indigenous populations and people with accelerated atherosclerosis.
And they really emphasise the importance of stratifying risk at discharge of having another major adverse cardiac event in the next 30 days. The protocol's pretty good at differentiating those patients that...
There's a term called accelerated diagnostic protocols, or ADPs, and we've got a number of different protocols now that are confidently being used around the world. One of them is the ADAPT ADP, which incorporates the TIMI score. There's also the HEART protocol, which uses the HEART score plus serial troponins that is used as well. And there are others such as the MAC score, which is a Manchester ACS score as well, that are reported and are used in different pockets. So it is the best evidence that we've got, and a lot better than what we used to do 10 years ago, I can tell you. It gives us some concrete guidance in the emergency setting, which is which patients can I send home safely? What is the likelihood of events within the next 30 days?
Yeah, And then finally, if we rule out unstable angina, then the next thing would be to determine the presence of stable angina. And so what's the time window there of differentiating that?
Depends a little bit on the system as to what you will do. So some places will observe these patients in an ED observation ward and do inpatient testing, definitive testing for these people at that point in time. Further testing, though, might also happen in an outpatient setting as well. So we've, in the guidelines, clarified now that objective testing for underlying coronary artery disease can be performed, you know, up to 14, but ideally sort of 7 days after presentation to the ED.
As part of the ADAPT study conducted in Brisbane and Christchurch, patients with possible cardiac symptoms excluding STEMI were stratified using an accelerated diagnostic protocol and observed prospectively. 20% of patients were classified as low risk for major adverse cardiac events within 30 days. Of these 392 patients, only one went on to represent with acute cardiac symptoms, demonstrating this protocol's effectiveness in identifying patients who can be safely discharged. In low to intermediate risk patients without contraindications for exercise, underlying ischemia can be revealed with a number of non-invasive tests, starting with stress echocardiography. If this is unavailable, exercise stress testing involving ECG is possible, but it has a higher rate of false positives and false negatives. Improvements in computer tomography have meant that CT coronary angiography now matches nuclear imaging modalities for sensitivity and specificity. It's capable of accurately localizing even subclinical atherosclerosis at lower direct costs and with shorter associated hospital stays. This has prompted the UK's health service to list CT coronary angiography as the first-line test for all patients with suspected ischemic heart disease. But according to two meta-analyses published this year, use of this technique also leads to higher rates of referral for invasive angiography and revascularization than other diagnostic techniques, without long-term improvement in mortality. In fact, the studies in BMJ and heart found that for low-risk ACS patients or those with stable disease, the recurrence rate of acute coronary events was comparable, regardless of which functional or anatomic modality was used to investigate. Only time will tell how this story evolves. The Cardiac Society guidelines indicate that all patients given a diagnosis of ischemic heart disease be discharged with a copy of their ECG and an angina symptom management plan. This would include guidance on the use of prescribed medications, how to recognise future symptoms, and when to call an ambulance. We'll get into this further in the next episode. For now, many thanks to Professor Louise Cullen for contributing her expertise for this episode of Pomegranate Health. I also want to thank the college members who provided editorial feedback on early drafts of this story. They've got most specialties and localities covered. For every episode, these clinicians are credited by name at the webpage racp.edu.au/pomcast. There you'll find links to all the literature mentioned, embedded in a complete transcript of the podcast. Please refer to the 2016 Australian Clinical Guidelines we've been talking about, or the summary published in the MJA. The New Zealand-specific guidelines, last updated in 2013, are also provided. There are links to the College Learning Series and other great resources. And you can claim CPD credits for listening, reading and watching by clicking through to My CPD. I'm Mick Cavazzini for the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.